All right, we're recording. Let's dive into this. So today I am joined by emotional and well-being therapist Lauren Ware, and this is the first time I get to say this. Lauren, welcome back to the show, because you're the first repeat.
Am I the first repeat?
You're the first repeat. So welcome back. Thank you for deciding to jump back into the fire.
Pleasure.
It's cozy over here. How are you? How you doing?
Yeah, I've been really good. It was COVID the last time that we caught up.
Because COVID disappeared now?
Has it gone? Well, it hasn't disappeared, but it was March last year and I sat here in my pajamas. I can remember looking back on that video going, okay.
Yeah, lots changed and it's gone quickly but slowly. I guess before we get into that, for anyone that isn't maybe familiar with your work, I mean, I give a very abridged version of emotional and mental wellness therapist, but that probably doesn't do justice to the truth of what you are. Yeah. Do you want to give a little bit of a sort of Cliff Notes version of what you do, your background, what you've studied and trained in, just super quick, so people that are listening know that you are the real deal and not just, you know, someone talking for talking's sake, of which we know there's many of those people around.
Some hack.
I'm the hack here. I'm the hack here. So you're the one to validate this thing. So
This one's called imposter syndrome and you just triggered mine. No.
No. You're about to undo all that when you talk about your background right now.
Yeah. So basically, yeah, I work as an emotional and mental wellness therapist now. I studied traditional kind of Western psychology in Australia. And I guess psychology is often used as a means to kind of diagnose and is very prescriptive about how it looks at humans. And I think the biochemical model, we spoke about this, I think, the last time as well, it tends to lend itself to kind of a ways not to die. And what I like to consider myself as teaching people how to live, and for me, it's mainly grounded in emotion. So how people feel, what's going on for them internally and psycho-emotionally. Because I feel like we don't have a lot of language around that. We get taught to think. We get taught, you know, cerebral literacy, verbal literacy, but we don't actually get taught about these visceral, beautiful, terrifying things called emotions. Like, they don't come with a manual. So that's kind of how I see myself kind of fitting into that kind of whole, I guess, medical framework or that whole model. Because, yeah, there is a lot of mental health pathology at the moment, and particularly with, you know, the last 12 months and everything's really been challenged. The way we see ourselves and the way we see the world around us is fundamentally changed, I think. Now my clients are really starting to, it's been a rite of passage in a lot of ways, actually. It's challenged people at the most fundamental level, from things like relationships to money to their health to, you know, family, friends, just housing, you know, it's the most fundamental things. And it's a beautiful thing to see, actually.
I think we've established immediately that there is no imposter syndrome, really, because you have all of that background and you've studied. No, but the fact that you've studied, and I know you've studied other philosophies beyond just traditional psychology, both Eastern and Western. So the reason I wanted you to give that little bit of background is to, and people can check this out on your site to go deeper into what you've done, but to just go to the fact that you have countless years and years and years of experience of training and doing and dealing with different people. You're not just someone who read a Tony Robbins book and thought, I'll do a website and do my thing, of which there's copious amounts. And just, you know, my audience being actors mainly, and there's plenty of people out there that have cropped up out of the blue who are now selling courses for bulletproof mindsets for actors. And I'm like, what difference does it make if you're an actor or not for the start? And also, just because you read Les Brown once doesn't make you an authority
on
all this stuff.
I mean, and I think too, like, I mean, I've been a guinea pig in a lot of my own social experiments as well, you know, like, I think you need to walk the walk and then talk the talk. I think, it's all part of it. It's all part of it. But yeah, I did, you're right. I grew up in a place in Australia called Byron Bay, and there's lots of alternative healers and therapists and acupuncturists. And so, yeah, that Eastern philosophy understanding for me has always been, I guess, a fundamental part of it, but I feel like we need to build a bridge between those two. I don't feel like they're...
You don't think it's there yet?
Is it?
No, you still don't? Really? Do you feel like, I mean, obviously you're not as tapped into the Eastern side because you're not physically there, but do you think that's more of a Western thing? Where I think in certain places, you know, I look at LA, there is a lot more alignment on a more popular sort of level with some of those philosophies. Mm-hmm. But if you're thinking of maybe other Western countries, do you still think there's a disparity and it's still very much traditional Western sort of physical only 3D model approach to everything? Or
that's a difficult one. I think it's a cultural shift at the end of the day.
Right.
You've got like individualist versus collectivist cultures. You've got, you know, that idea, I guess, particularly that stems from traditional Chinese medicine about meridian energy and using kind of, I guess, physics as a means, as a medicinal property.
Whereas I think that's the key, don't you?
Very much biology as a means of,
yeah,
of medical. Kind of
it's the physics part, I think, that could be the key. It was for me too, right? Because yeah. Otherwise, if you told me this stuff 10 years ago and I was younger and more naive anyway, but I would have gone, it's woo-woo hippie stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
But when you give me the physics and I go to the base level and you're talking about energy and atoms and vibration and stuff like that, I look at that and go, well, I get that logically.
Yeah,
I get that. But then why does it not apply maybe on a more macro level? And then I can't argue against it, even though I feel like I'm wired to. And mm-hmm. that was for me the key. Do you think that's the angle we're going to have to go down on a collective route to get people to see the physics side more?
I don't know. I don't think this is something you can intellectualize. It's like trying to intellectualize a piece of music. And I guess for me, because I've come from a music background, it's almost like I've always believed in something that's completely intangible, because music isn't tangible. So for me, that energy side just automatically just seemed to, pardon the pun, but resonate for me. Like there was a resonance around that way of looking at my well-being that maybe wasn't present in that purely biological
way. So let me ask you this then, Lauren. Do you feel like this last year, and was you mentioned some of your clients, the fact that in some cases it's given people the chance to have slightly less distractions than normal, perhaps forced people inward, or maybe people have chosen to go inward. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like that has been an opportunity for people to maybe connect with that intangible in a way that they wouldn't have had the chance to do before, which then maybe is going to unlock this change in perspective that wasn't maybe there previously? Do you feel like this has been a silver lining, for lack of a term?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And I think it's this whole idea. I mean, there's this catch cry that I say it all the time now, and I feel like I'm becoming a bit of a broken record, but we're taught to think, we're not taught to feel. And so, and I mean, thoughts are energetic as well, like, but we've become very cerebral and very cognitive as a kind of culture. And I think and emotions are an energy. They're an internal kind of energy. They're an experience. And so often I will ask people, you know, how are you experiencing yourself rather than what do you think? A lot of people are very inclined to come and tell you what they think about things, but not very much how they feel. And so I think what this time has really done for people is forced them into their emotions. You've got no way out. You know, when you were sat in lockdown for the best part of 12 months, we thought it was going to be 3 when we were on the last podcast. The best part of 12 months, you've had to face yourself, you know, and I think that's where it starts.
Yeah. Do you feel I've been too stressed? We spoke about this, I think, when we weren't recording the other week. Do you think there's two kind of camps of people, the ones that face themselves and the ones that just still found a way not to?
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be the interesting sort of shift as we come out of it, to see who did the work, whether they wanted to or not, because sometimes the work does you. And who just kept getting the same repeat things in their life they've always had come up and not use it as a chance to shift, you know? And do you feel that there is those two camps, or am I just maybe blanketing it a little bit too broadly?
No, I think on a more general level, absolutely. Like the depth to which you are able to experience yourself always is a precursor for how how much you can self-actualize, for want of a better word, like how, you know, the depth to which you can allow yourself to really feel is the extent to which you can, I guess, bring about, you know, change in the world and bring about change in yourself and in your relationships. And yeah, it's really fascinating to me, because it's almost like there's this, it's not necessarily just two camps, but if you go, J.K. Rowling, there was a beautiful quote, and she said, "And so my rock bottom became the solid foundation on which I rebuilt my life." It was attributed to her. I'm pretty sure it's her that said it too. But someone can go source check that.
If it's on the internet down as her, then it's her. That's how it works in the world these days.
Particularly when you're on Instagram.
You know, don't get me started.
But yeah, so, and once you hit that rock bottom, and so the extent to which you can rise is almost the extent to which you can fall as well. You know, it's like when you hit that rock bottom, when you go to that emotionally dark place, you have the opportunity to really break open. You know, for me, I've had a breakdown in my life. And for me now, looking back on it, it wasn't a breakdown, it was a breakthrough.
But I guess it's all framed through where you're at the time. And obviously the prism you see it through at the time is not going to feel like a breakthrough. Mm-hmm. And there's in my head, there's different things I want to jump off to with just that one sentence you said, but I'm going to sort of pick one first. Mm-hmm. Because I want to try and find stuff that's practical for people that are listening. I think it's great to talk about things empirically, but you know, if I'm on the other side of this, I'm going to go, cool, great guys, sounds good. But what the fuck do I do with that if I wanted to? Mm-hmm. When you're in it, when you're in that clunky place and you don't know logically that it's a breakdown, maybe you might feel it, I don't know. But when you're sitting in that shadow or that dark place or whatever you want to label it as, what can people do to try and navigate through that? Because you look at it and you can't see how it's ever going to end. It seems like your life is in doom forever. Everything is just being pulled from under you. That's the time when people need the tools. And to your point, we're not taught those things. Mm-hmm. So let's try and, I don't want to say teach people, because that sounds a bit sort of preachy, but what techniques or tools could people maybe attempt to use or try if they're going through a rocky period, whether it's rock bottom or just a little bit of a wobble and they want to try and cleanse their energy and just move on to a more higher vibration? Mm-hmm. What do you suggest?
A lot of people go about their emotions trying to eradicate them. So basically what they will do is they will turn, when they hit that rock bottom, when they go into those crunchy bits, those emotions that they don't want to feel, those really uncomfortable, just clunky kind of emotions, is that they will numb. They will turn to food, they will turn to sex, porn use over lockdown, massive, went absolutely bananas. They did that's a whole nother, I could go on a whole other tangent there. You know, or they use on other people, on relationships. They go to their partner to make them feel better. The drugs and alcohol, huge one. So basically, rather than learn to navigate, we've taught ourselves to eradicate emotion, right? So
is that like reaching for a pacifier that's a temporary reprieve for like a minute or two?
Netflix was a huge one.
Sure. Sure. And this is the thing, right? Like, it's not wrong
exactly
to use these things. I guess it's the self-awareness to know that I'm doing it and that this is not a solution in the long run. My short term, it's almost like that analogy, the super cliche of the boat which has holes with the water coming through, and I'm just tapping it with like a little plaster or band-aid for the Americans. But the water still is gonna sink eventually the ship or the boat. So is it being able to go, I know what I'm doing by watching Netflix or by whatever, like going on Pornhub or by eating loads of cake, but I know that it's not going to solve this in the long run and I can't do this in perpetuity. Is that the frame shift to have, to give yourself a little bit of, don't beat yourself up about what you're doing, but you do have to change eventually? Or do we think we should try and have a tool that lets us not even have to fall on those things if we don't want to?
Well, they're all useful. This is the thing that I mean, okay. I'm not advocating for going and getting high and drunk just FYI. But
I am, so go for it, people. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
Not on brand. No. but it's ultimately the extent. It all starts with self-awareness. So it's about learning to navigate our emotions. It's about learning to navigate them, and it all starts with self-awareness. So basically, it's about time we got aware of our emotions and we got curious about what they're trying to tell us. So the first thing that I would always say when people are in crunchy emotions and they're like, I don't want to feel this, like, Lauren, I'm anxious as hell. Okay, anxiety is a great one, actually, because anxiety for me is something that I've experienced myself throughout my life. It's the thing that's made me high functioning, but it's also had me in the fetal position next to that radiator over there several times, you know? And so things as and of themselves aren't necessarily bad or good. It's about how we use them. It's about how we actualize them. And so it's almost like, you know, everybody, it seems to me now, everybody's like, you know, got five ways to beat anxiety, or, you know, we'll get you well in five sessions. No. It's about our relationships with everything. It's about our relationships with money. It's about our relationships with sex. It's about our relationships with people, with education, with learning, with our feelings. And for me, this all begins and ends in self-awareness and curiosity. So if you can sit with whatever it is and get curious and try to be aware of why you're doing what you're doing, that will circumvent those emotions, and the emotions then pass. It's this classic spiritual idea of "this too shall pass."
It's like, and correct me if I'm misinterpreting it, but the money, the relationships, the job, the whatever externalized thing that we need to have a relationship with are all subsets of that first core pillar, which is the relationship you have with yourself. I know, Hallmark and cheesy, but I think we've all heard that to some extent. Mm-hmm. And
Jay, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and I think
you
people
love yourself.
But I think people consciously think that we're doing that, and I think maybe that's the thing, that you can't implicitly and consciously always. It goes beyond that, I suppose, you know, because we have all these stories and wirings that we've had ingrained in us since we were kids, mm-hmm. that are there subconsciously, that even though we logically go, yeah, I love myself and I'm great and I'm this and I'm worthy and all that stuff, mm-hmm. that's operating at, like, you know, 1/10 of what your subconscious is operating at. And so the subconscious sort of program might be saying, no, you're fucking not. Mm-hmm. But we can't see that. And that's the thing that's running the show, and we don't know. And that's when it starts to get frustrating. Because mm-hmm. I think then people go, I'm telling myself all these great things and it's still not changing. Mm-hmm. That's when you feel like you're stuck. Mm-hmm. How do people start to navigate that space? Because that's not an overnight change.
It's not. And it's practice every single day. I still do my own practice every single day around it, because Carl Jung, who is my favorite, you know this, he's my favorite human that ever existed, but he said that he who looks outside dreams and he who looks inside awakens. And it's this ability to be able to be true to yourself, because I really hear you around this whole, you know, you can't affirm yourself enough, and this whole idea of telling myself 50 affirmations a day and that somehow that will magically change everything, that's actually almost not true. And one of my favorite therapists talks about it almost like a painter's palette, and he talks about, you know, the people that only ever access the light colors on their palette, they're not a whole human, because you need those dark colors. But unfortunately, our culture has dichotomized the dark colors as bad and the light colors as good, for use of the metaphor, you get the idea. So, but and because we're so terrified of experiencing those dark colors, we don't go there. We don't go there, and that's where all the good stuff is. In my experience of it, like, I had to go through, you know, I had to let myself experience the anger. I had to let myself experience grief. Heaven forbid, I had to let myself experience shame, which in our culture is an emotion that is completely taboo. You know, it's one of those things. You say the word shame and you watch people duck for cover. But you, it's almost like if you allow yourself to go there, there is so much good stuff. And this is why it's hard, because I can't just say to you, here's five tools to make you, you know, because that's not where the work is. The work is actually, in the first instance, getting honest with yourself, mm-hmm. that radical honesty. And then if you can't see, if there's blinkers in the way, that's okay too. And that's where, I mean, dare I say it, I'm a massive advocate for good therapy, because it saved my life countless times, you know, to have in the psychotherapeutic community, they call it an enlightened witness, for example, or just someone where you can show up and you can really genuinely experience yourself, and that they can hold that space for you without judgment, so that you can actually work through your own bullshit, basically. Can I say bullshit? Probably.
I've been swearing like a trooper, so you can say whatever you want. Bullshit's like sort of an amber light on the scale of what I've said earlier, so you're good.
Okay, that's fair enough. Good.
Say whatever you like. I'll bleep you out if it's not on brand for you.
No, I swear like a truck driver most of the time.
Right, go for it. Yeah, that's where I think, coming from like an actor's perspective, I think a good caveat, good acting class, mm-hmm. is like therapy, but not in a sit down and share your feelings. Well, that, to be fair, we do that too, but it is in a being okay to express and go into all those sides. And you know, it can take quite a few years of being in a good class to start to feel comfortable to access and chip away at all of those different parts, to then go, everything is potentially possible. And by that I mean, I don't reside as being an aggressive or angry person or dark or whatever it might be that we label as negative. Mm-hmm. But the potentiality of that emotion still exists within me, as it does within all of us. Mm-hmm. To be able to tap into that in a safe place and express it, whether it's through performance or just talking about it as an idea that we have in our head, mm-hmm. I think, to your point, lets us almost transmute that energy and face it, and not feel like we're separate from it, but also not feel like it could own us or overrun us. I think that's the implicit fear, that if I tap into that, what does it mean about me? It's this whole identity that we feel like we have to build up for ourselves. So I guess I'm just talking about that from a class side, because it's something that people could look at and see as one way of accessing those shadow emotions. I guess other ways you've mentioned are like therapy, going to a good counselor.
Mm-hmm. Music, you know, a lot of the performing arts is brilliant for this sort of stuff. But even if it's, you know, I suppose speaking to a girlfriend the other day, and I'm going to get some drop sheets now that the shops are open again, and just go down the back and like Jackson Pollock the hell out of a canvas. So like, you know, just for, it's to tonify these emotions when they come up. But when you, it's interesting to me that you were just talking about acting classes. When you experience those emotions as an actor, do you experience them as yourself, or do you experience them almost actualizing as a character?
I think in a good acting class, you're taught that there is no real distinction between you and the character per se. Whilst, yes, you create a character, mm-hmm. ultimately it has to come from some sense of truth and authenticity to you as the human. And the only way you can do that is if you tap into your innate experiences and who you are as an individual. Mm-hmm. So if the performance seems false, it's because the person is doing a caricature and they're not tapping into who they are. My way I've always looked at it is it's sort of like levers, like on a sound mixer, which you'll resonate with this being a musician. Mm-hmm. So you have all the different levers in the sound studio where you're mixing. And I think everybody has a preset level where it's set at a certain level that's just our baseline that we show up at. But I could go and take the bass and dial it up and turn down the treble and play mm-hmm. with some distortion. And that's going to completely change how I show up physically and in the space. That might not be how you see me on my base level, but it's still me. It's just I'm, as an actor, we're trained to know how to, as best as we can, understand those emotions to play with the levels. Mm-hmm. But they have to come from a place of truth.
That's really interesting. Yeah, and I mean, you do see that. You see it in actors all the time, this kind of level of authenticity that they can kind of show up with. Yeah, but I mean, I do tend to find, and being a creative myself, it's almost like the access to those emotions doesn't mean that we learn how to use them. Because for me, as a performer back in the day, I could very easily access those emotions and I could very easily put them into my art, but it didn't mean that I inherently knew.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's that when you're doing it in the art, it feels like you're giving yourself a pass. Mm-hmm. To dwell in it.
Mm-hmm.
When you come into your own life, which isn't really anything different, but you tell yourself it is,
yeah,
you're not then going to tap into that as easily.
Mm.
Having said that, I think the simple act of just going into that space still gives you some awareness of it if and when that shows up as a gremlin without you knowing in your regular life.
Because this is the thing, like I remember when I had my breakdown and I was performing a lot and I always felt like I was on transmit. It's the only way I can describe it. If we're talking about energetically, like I was a signal, I was on transmit, you know, and I was putting things out there to the world and it was almost like I was hemorrhaging all this energy. But I wasn't, because, and I think it comes down to then the locus of control. So, or how we're showing up. So for me, when your locus of control is external, when you need that validation externally through vanity metrics on social media, through a musician, I always used to say a musician is the only job in the world where you expected everyone to clap every 3 minutes after you finished performing, you know? And so it's almost like, whereas I think when you're back to what I was saying about Carl Jung, the outside dreams, inside awakens, if you can conjure up those emotions within yourself and express them, but without
expectations.
And without that being on transmit. It was like Marilyn Monroe and how she said about she wanted the whole world to love her. And again, she had this amazing talent, could tap into all this emotion, but then had an external locus of control. Whereas I think if you have all of that emotion and then an internal locus of control, like an internal sense of, this is who I am. I'm just showing up and I'm being of service. I'm just doing my art. It's a very different experience and was for me.
And I think that's it, no matter what walk of life it is, whether it's performing arts or a job or building your own business or relationships, mm-hmm. it's showing up to give.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's a cheesy Hallmark alert for people again, because I'm using these Instagram cliches, but that sounds easy and simple, and it isn't, for the simple fact that you can't really do it unless you've really done all the work on yourself to feel full enough
mm-hmm.
to do that, as opposed to giving with expectations. Now, I don't know how that's something that we can guide people to or teach, because I think it's unique to each individual.
Mm-hmm.
But do you have any thoughts on that? And as a, I think it's an ongoing practice, but is there sort of, how can people go inward to feel full enough of themselves to then go outward?
Yeah, that's it. And but it's really interesting that you put it that way, because it's that whole biblical idea of thy cup runneth over, you know, and it's so, and again, it's this idea, and it does sound cliche, but it's like you need to fill up your own cup first, and then whatever comes out is for other people, you know. And I think relationships is a really good example, actually, of that. Because I think a lot of people go to their romantic partners, or another biblical idea of worshipping false idols, this idea that we're going to find ourselves in romantic love, or find ourselves in money, or find ourselves in a business, or, again, external locus of control, to use the psychology term, like that we're externalizing our gods, basically. We're turning romantic love into a god. I mean, all you need to do is look at something like Love Island and everything that happened with Carolyn Flack, you know, and desperately sad that situation is when we can only see ourselves as mirrored through someone else's eyes. You know, this idea that romantic love has taken on this godlike status. And you look at any good art, that's like a lot of that is about romantic love. Yeah, but romance and finance, if there's two things that tend to fuck humans up, it's those two.
And I guess it's not saying that there's anything wrong with those things or desiring them. It's more, I guess, going out into the world towards those things from a place of knowing you don't need it per se.
Yeah. Yeah.
That doesn't, like, again, do you feel like that would be something people would traverse more succinctly if they were taught this from a younger age? Or do you think that, to your point before, it's not logical and you have to go through the life experiences a little bit to actually be able to then navigate that in a more grounded way? You know what?
Big question.
I know it's what I do. I don't help you at all.
It's a big question because, honest opinion for me, and this is purely, this isn't grounded in anything but my own experience, is that as a sense of something bigger than ourselves, a sense of reverence of a higher power, of God, of the universe, of whatever you want to call it, has decreased, so has our reliance on things like money and sex usually, because that's what consumer capitalism wants us to believe, that those things are our God. And so then, you know, whereas when we realize that, you know, that God exists within us as us, and not God in like a Catholic Bible bashing kind of sense, God as in your definition of a power greater than you, you might call it the Tao, you might call it the universe, whatever that is. I think until we've got a concept of something and a reverence for something bigger than us, it's very, very hard to not worship false idols. It's very, very hard to not worship, you know, oh, just until I meet my Prince Charming, or, you know, until I've got $1 million.
Yeah.
It's that idea. And where capitalism's overtaken religion, that's and scientific method, that's kind of what we're left with.
You see people sort of chasing these things and then getting them, and then after 3 or 6 months or whatever, realizing they don't feel, and if anything, they feel worse because they sort of are just hitting the same loops they've always hit. Sometimes getting themselves into deeper and deeper shit, for lack of a term.
Mm-hmm.
It's that whole idea of, you know, wherever you go, there you'll be. And again, I don't think there's anything wrong in the pursuit or desire of things outwardly, because it's the polarity, I guess, of we exist within both spheres.
Mm-hmm.
We're here to be able to experience these things outwardly and desire these things and create them, but also we're also here to experience it internally and maybe understand that what happens outwardly doesn't have to be a complete train wreck of a shit show that just seems to happen to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a lot of the time, and you know, I've experienced it, I'm sure you have. You think that stuff's just happening around you and you have no control over it, mm-hmm. and you don't understand why. And sometimes it is, sure, but a lot of the times we don't want to take the reins and try and focus on how we can maybe empower ourselves and create and cultivate things in our world, because that seems like, you know, who are we to do that?
Yeah. And I think responsibility in that way equals freedom. You know, when you don't make someone else responsible for your happiness, or when you don't make something else responsible for your happiness, when you fully embody that actually no one's coming to fix me, no one's coming to save me, that's actually my job, it's utterly terrifying and completely liberating at exactly the same time, because you go, oh, shit. Okay, so if no one else is coming to fix me, no one's coming to save me, then
now what?
Yeah, pretty much. Then I'm the only one. And then you start to think about it more and you're like, yeah, but I'm the only one. You know, it's this. And again, it's all about that moment is all about how you frame it. It's all about how you frame it, because you can go, oh, like, you know, that. Always think about this idea of responsibility is something that there's responsibility and there's honesty, and there's a few kind of touchstones that I've worked with myself, and particularly over the past year, and this idea of service as well, that for me are really the hallmarks of someone that has good mental health. You know, someone that can show up and be radically honest, someone that can show up and take responsibility for their emotions and be humble about it. Humility is another huge one. And again, these are all things that spirituality used to teach us: humility, grace, all these ideas, service, honesty. And it's actually not to serve other people. It's actually to serve ourselves. But we missed the memo somewhere, and it kind of got thwarted through kind of patriarchal Judeo-Christian conditioning. Yeah. And here we are.
Yeah. And that idea of there's something wrong with you if you're being selfish, that it's selfish to only care about yourself. And I don't think we're saying ignore others or not be selfless. That's not the point, or not be kind or empathetic. But I think you can't be of any value to someone if you don't have the ability to, again, fill your own cup. Mm-hmm. That just feels like it's a bigger control mechanism that's been in place to sort of keep people from going inward, because God forbid if they do.
Well, and that's it. And but then the external has tapped these internal emotions as well. Like, you know, you can't buy a car without seeing, you know, an attractive woman on it or something like that. So it's tapped your internal emotional experience in order to sell something.
Yeah.
And so it's this, it's honestly, that is really big.
You're talking about mental health there, and you were kind of unpacking it a little bit about what that looks like in a, I don't want to use the word good mental health because that's very ambiguous, but healthy mental health.
Yeah.
Can we talk about that a little bit more? Because I think that could be quite useful for people, especially with the year that some might have had, to just understand, you know, what are some of those core pillars and how they can sort of start letting themselves show up with that in their lives more prominently.
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's just to define what I think love actually is, is, and I know we spoke about this once before, but for me, love is honor and service of self and others. Self first, then other people. So to serve myself, I need to be honest. I need to make sure I pay my taxes. I may need to make sure I don't, you know, covet other people's partners. I need to make sure that, you know, I'm being honest with myself about, oh God, any number of things that we can justify and we can rationalize. And actually rationalizing is probably the antithesis to a lot of this sort of stuff. But, you know, it does come. And then, so if we work from that place, if love is honor of self and others, then okay, so how do I honor and serve? And that comes down to, it does. It comes down to honesty. It comes down to humility. And humility means, you know, it comes down, you know, allowing yourself to be vulnerable, saying sorry when you've done the wrong thing, admitting when you're wrong. A lot of us are not good at that. I'm particularly bad at it, actually. I don't like, and I'm getting better. Again, and this is where the practice comes in. It's having awareness of that and then kind of owning it. And a lot of us see these negative emotions as a weakness, or these concepts as a weakness. To be humble is somehow to be weak. And I think, it's an interesting one. There was something I wanted to say about that, but it's gone out of my head. So anyway, but and the other main one that I said before, I think too, is this idea of radical honesty. It's like when you can have a conversation with someone and not try and fix their feelings, but just, and have that conversation that makes you feel squirmy, that like has you sitting there in a chair, those conversations are absolute gold.
Do you feel that sometimes or most times people shy away from them because it's sort of like a Mexican standoff where you are more concerned about their reaction? Because this is the thing, you might feel full enough to express your feelings and thoughts, your fear isn't so much that, it's more the other person's reaction, really. And it's that notion of, if I say this, are they then going to just disappear? Because a lot of people are then great at dishing it out but not hearing it back. And it's that sort of do unto others thing, you know, if I say this to them, would I feel comfortable hearing it back? I know a lot of times you see people, you say something to them, and if they don't like it, the wall goes up, they lash out, and they disappear.
And maybe that's what they needed to do.
Perhaps.
And this is my point. Like, when you start to get radically honest, you soon see, and this is why we don't do it, because we're afraid of losing people out of our lives, that we've got this, that we haven't gotten okay with the idea of impermanence. And it's the most fundamental law of, like, humanity. We're all going to die, yet we're all terrified of impermanence. Like, but sometimes I've had to set a boundary. And if those people aren't in my life anymore, it's shown me who I want to have around me. I want people that I can be with.
Sure.
And so why are we so terrified of the fact that someone's not going to be able to meet us where we need them to? You know, so there's an element of, yeah, it's interesting because I think that's what stops a lot of people setting boundaries, if I'm honest.
And the reason I think I was...
abandonment, you know?
Sure. And I think the reason I bring that up is that idea of everybody's on such a different level in their own journey, mm-hmm. that not to say you're in a different place or a better place, just they're on a different stage of their path. Mm-hmm. If someone's not reciprocal to your radical honesty, mm-hmm. it doesn't mean that one day they might not be. It just means that they're not open to that now. Mm-hmm. And I feel sometimes you go back to relationships and what you were touching on before, that's where a lot of people fall into unhealthy relationships, or, and I don't just mean romantic, it could be even with just family members or friends, where there is that fear of expressing what's on your mind because you don't know where the other person is, mm-hmm. in their life, and not being okay enough to just say, well, all right, if you need to go and do your thing, maybe you'll circle back one day, maybe not.
Yeah, and that's the whole internal locus of control thing on steroids, because then you bring another person into it. Something happened out there.
You got a break in?
No, it wasn't. It was downstairs. It's all good. But this is the foibles of doing everything on Zoom nowadays. But I'm surprised, actually, my dog hasn't made a cameo somewhere in the background yet.
He will now you've said that.
Yeah, tell me if she does.
He will. She will.
Yeah, she's too busy out there checking out the whatever just fell over. Where was I? But yeah, so it's almost like this idea about like the radical. It's this internal locus of control on steroids, because then you're dealing with another whole human, and particularly when I talk about romantic love, and if your sense of yourself is reflected in, particularly, let's face it, you know, in romantic love, that tends to be the place that it's the most
mirrored,
prevalent. Yeah. And so then when your locus of control is out there and looking to your partner or your lover to, in order to feel better, it's like, I've completely lost my train of thought, because it's a bloody thing. Yeah, so when this sense of ourselves isn't... No, Ash, it's gone completely. I can't even remember what it was.
It'll come back eventually. It'll come back. No. I guess it's that idea of the reason I guess people have a lot of challenges in the romantic sphere is because they're looking outwardly to the other person to fulfill them, which is never going to work in the long run. I guess that's why divorce rates are so high. That's why we've seen, you know, on average, after a couple of years, people split up because they stop seeing the Hollywood Disney idea that they saw in the first 3 to 6 months, where the first 3 to 6 months is just chemicals, as opposed to true. There's a difference between true love and lust. And I think we don't have a good understanding sometimes of the difference between the two in those early stages. And, mm-hmm. you know, there's having a romance with someone, and there's having a partnership with someone where you're actively coming together to build something. Mm-hmm. And yeah. Both are fine at different stages in your life. It's not to sort of say one is better or worse, but it's always in the latter, that thing of, to your point, you're coming already full enough within yourself. Mm-hmm. Now the challenge is finding and coming across people that are also doing that inner work on their side, so that you are meeting each other on a reasonably even level playing field where you can then reciprocate. And so it's just an organic dance. And I think oftentimes we'll hit the wall because the other person is resonating on a slightly different wavelength because they're just not there yet. And I don't really have a point to that. It just feels like that sort of seems like the norm, and that's where we end up, I guess, settling for.
Yeah, and we don't set boundaries, and we don't express ourselves because we're terrified of that other person leaving. And back to what I was saying before about this idea of impermanence, I think when you've got that internal locus of control, when you've got that solid foundation, back to my J.K. Rowling quote, it's like, when I've got that solid foundation, yes, I may lose my job. Yes, I may lose my business. Yes, I may lose my love or my, you know, partner. Or I may not live a life as my parents predetermined I ought to have, heaven forbid. But I'm okay. Like, I've got this. I can do this. And it's not the end of everything. Where I think when we're worshipping false idols, when we've got this idea that in order to be okay, I need to have this. You know, that's where, for me personally, I've fallen over so many times looking to, you know, I've moved countries, you know, I've tried all of it, trust me, you know, I've had everything. And I think, I've had everything and that's not it.
Yeah, it's that thing of when you chase the thing.
Mm-hmm.
I heard, I think it was Downey Jr. was on the Rogan show a few years ago. And I'm going to butcher this because I don't remember the full context, but he was talking about his learning of not the thing you want that badly is the thing you should chase the least.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're going to choke all the air out of it and you don't give it space to breathe. Mm-hmm. And your need to chase is just a reflection on the fact that you have more inner work to do. And if you see it from that frame, you actually would go inwards and focus on, okay, this is a sign that I need to focus a bit more on some part of myself and give that thing space to maybe come to me in its own way. But like you're saying, when we feel like we have to fill up from outwards, we'll chase the job, the person, the thing, the relationship, the family, which are all great things to have. But again, it's, you know, do you want to have a family because you want to create a life for a child and give something to them that's meaningful? Or do you just want it because you want a Barbie doll?
Mm-hmm. And because of how it makes you look and because of how it makes you feel.
That's a big one, huh? How it makes you look to other people.
Oh my God, yes. Or because it's what your mom and dad did and that's what they expect you to do. You know, it's almost like... And I think it's this idea, as you say with the Robert Downey Jr. piece, is that this idea of receptivity that we create. I heard Alan Watts talk about it at one point as well. And it's almost like if you move backwards in a pool and you're teaching a child to swim, and it'll almost create this suction that will draw them towards you, because it's like almost like you create the concept, even energetically, of receptivity is this vacuum-like space. You create the space for the right thing to come in for you. You don't create this, or you don't basically then try and force your will on the world. You serve the world as it is, and you love it as it is, and you be grateful for it as it is. And I think the people that I know that have had the most success emotionally and spiritually and materially are those people that have allowed life on life's terms.
So people are going to hear that and get triggered, that good old word triggered that people don't like. But because
everywhere at the moment, everyone's about everything.
Sure. But because I think with that, there's the part of the ego that'll go, so I'm not supposed to want anything. And I think maybe there's a distinction, which maybe I'll sort of start where I think it lies and you can actually correct me and fill it in properly, which is,
which is,
I think we need to have desires and consciously and very deliberately actually have a view of what we desire and want, and even think about it, visualize it, whatever it is, to want to create those aspects and even get specific with it. But then the trick is to be able to give the space for that to come into your life and let go. It's almost, how can you desire without expectations?
Oof, that is perfect. And we circle straight back around to the only reason that we ever want anything at all is for how it makes us feel.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're, and I talk about this a lot around kind of sex and sexuality, actually, because a lot of us have externalized our sexuality as well with things like porn, with things like, okay, in order to feel a certain way, I need this, this, and this. However, these feelings are our feelings. They're going on inside of us, and we can access them whenever we need to.
Mm.
And the point is that they belong to us first. And so ultimately, you said about desire. I desire to have a family. I desire. Okay, so what's desire to you? What does it look like? How does it feel? Feel that on the inside. All of a sudden, it magically appears on the outside. That's the secret.
Oh, you said the secret. Uh-oh. You said.
I went there.
Yeah, well, I have my own views on that book, yeah. and thing, which I think is based on strong kernels of truth, but very well marketed to only give people they give people the sort of formula, but not really the truth of how to. Mm-hmm.
Because it takes work. This is the thing, that there is no, and I think anybody that's peddling you like like 5 steps to self-actualization is talking absolute bullshit, because everyone.
What have you read? Some blog has really pissed you off because this 5 steps is coming up over and over again.
They're everywhere, though. You only have to just go on YouTube.
Well, that's marketing.
Like, someone's like, 10 steps to make him fall in love with you. 10
that's
steps
just marketing. Hey, if you think it takes 10 steps to make him fall in love, you're wrong. There's basically like 3.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I've lost my train of thought because, oh yes, there's the, no, I'm back with the secret. I remember a Dave Chappelle sketch or bit of a stand up where he was going on about this thing and saying, so you're telling me someone who's starving in some remote place in the world in Africa, all I have to do is that starving person is just think about food and magically there's going to be like, you know, a roast chicken and potatoes. And it was his way of flamethrowing it on a very sort of macro level to the masses. But I think subtly there was also that comment of, sure, if you bust your ass on doing the work internally. And I guess the key is what you're saying, which is that thing of, if you can feel these things in of yourself without having them already in your life, mm-hmm. you create the space for that ripple effect to potentially come to you.
Yeah. And desire is a feeling in as much as hunger is, you know, and it propels us. It propels us to do something about it.
That's it, right? It's the action. Mm-hmm. Like just sitting and visualizing is great, but you have to show up as well in the world.
Yeah, it's bi-directional. This communication is, and I'm just saying, sit and feel desire all day, and all of a sudden you'll be completely sexually satisfied for the rest of your life. That's not what I'm saying at all.
Sure.
But what I'm saying is that if we allow the feeling to come first, and we understand that feeling is ours, the feeling and the experience of ourselves in these emotions propels us in the direction that we need to go.
But that feels like it's the harder part, right? Because that's then asking people, like you said earlier, to understand their feelings and be able to, I guess, because when the feelings aren't nice, you just want, it's easy to dwell in them.
Yeah, I just want to go on like here and like be like.
Yeah, so it's then how can you, number one, be self-aware enough to acknowledge the feeling and then somehow have a practice that lets you pivot into a different one that's more empowering? Because that feels like that's the tool that you want to work with over time and build that muscle to sort of go, you know, like Joe Dispenza has this thing in one of his talks where he talks about try and when you catch yourself, just tell yourself change. And try and practice it enough so that eventually you can shift into something a little less heavy and pivot into an emotion that is more empowering.
Yeah.
Are there things that people can do beyond that? Or again, is it just repetition and practice?
Repetition and practice mainly, but yeah, absolutely. It's having that awareness. And just by listening to something like this, it'll trigger something in your brain that will go the next time you're scrolling through social media, if you really want to change. And again, that desire to change, that desire to do something differently. Humans aren't going to do things unless they're motivated to. You know, it's this idea about someone being happily numb. Things have got to get suitably shit for you to want to change.
Why is that?
God, I wish I knew.
Or more, maybe not easier question, but is there a way, because I get you, like we're hardwired to seem like that's the only time we make the mega shift.
Mm-hmm. Is there we love a way? What's familiar. Like, honestly, if you've been married for 25 years and you've got your house and you've got your missus and everything's all sorted and you're like sitting back, don't have to make food, like everything's normal, you're not loving your life, but you're not hating it either.
So do we love that? Do we love that comfortable place? Because I guess to a point we do, but on a deeper level, which we'll never express to anyone outwardly, we don't feel fulfilled because we're not letting ourselves grow. That's why I say, do we like it? Because we just show that we are, oh yeah, it's great. But actually internally.
Yeah. And that's where you see people start to act out. They will start to, you know, have affairs. They'll start to, you know, take drugs or drink or blah, blah, blah. Because again, it's their, that emotional landscape, that internal ground still in there. Everybody wants that. Everybody wants to self-actualize. And I don't know anybody that couldn't tell me something that wouldn't break my heart, you know? And I think this idea that we all have this calling. It's just whether or not
you want to listen.
Ultimately, yes. Or and you've got two choices. You can either listen and kind of slay the dragon. I think I've said that to you before. Or on the alternative, you can sit there happily numb forever and never really get uncomfortable enough to really want to do anything about it. But and there's no wrong way. There's just a way.
Sure. I guess in the latter, though, you're going to keep getting things showing up in your life to kind of say, yeah, this again, you want to deal with it now? No? Okay.
You're on the shoulder. Yeah.
How about this time? No. Okay. It's going to get progressively like more and more painful for you. No, not. Mm-hmm. And there's always that niggling thing that'll keep showing up.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. It's the idea of, I guess, Joseph Campbell's Hero's Journey.
I just love that movie.
And he talks about all the different stages, but I think the one that we've kind of maybe touched on but not given the label, I hate labels, but given the label to, is that idea of Dark Night of the Soul.
Oh, yes.
Which actually isn't really his. I think it goes back to, I think it was some Spanish like poet or saint in the 16th century or something. He talked about it and I know Eckhart Tolle speaks to it as well, and just this idea of we may have many of them in our lives, but there's usually one or two that come up, and it's that what you were saying before, hitting rock bottom. Mm-hmm. But that's where everything happens in such a way that all the external stuff you felt and thought you wanted crumbles and your identity dissipates, and that's when you're, it's interesting because in writing that there is a formulaic step to how you would write a film. Mm-hmm. And that idea of Dark Night of the Soul is implicitly linked to the notion of a character's wants and needs. Mm-hmm. So when you're writing a story, you start out writing the main character, the protagonist, with what they want. Mm-hmm. So take it into the real world. We all have wants and desires. Mm-hmm. I want the relationship, the house, the whatever. At some point in the story, they get what they want, but realize what they wanted isn't really what fulfilled them. Mm-hmm. And then eventually a dark night of the soul happens. So something takes place where everything they thought they wanted dissipates. Mm-hmm. And they have to then face what's called the all is lost moment, which is everything's gone. They are at rock bottom. Someone or something will show a different perspective to them to approach life from a new vantage point. Mm-hmm. And they then realize that their journey wasn't about what they wanted outward. It's what they needed, which is usually something more fulfilling and inward. So Breaking Bad as an example, Walter White wants to sell crystal meth to make loads of money. He does all of that. Really what he needs is that feeling of peace.
Mm-hmm. And that's all any of us want, really.
But that dark night of the soul is what I think we're talking about. And so that either shows up, well, it always shows up and drags you kicking and screaming. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like COVID for many in the pandemic has been a dark night of the soul experience for a lot to face up to that bottom?
Absolutely. And I think it's been a collective suffering, and it's been an ego death on many, many levels, you know, as you say, you know, that part of you gets dragged kicking and screaming, but it's not who you really are. It's just that mask almost that you've created in order to feel okay. So, you know, Breaking Bad example, selling crystal meth for shit tons of money. Like, you know, there's been several times in so many of our lives where the version of ourselves that we've created isn't who we are. It isn't there. It isn't coming from a place of honor and service. It's not coming from a place of love. It's coming from a place of, oh shit, I need to get by in the world, I need money. It's worshiping all the false idols. And then it's sitting back and allowing that part of us to die is painful. just painful. Like,
and I guess the key word there is allowing, right, Lauren? Because you could resist it and try and keep hold onto the mask and the false identity.
Yeah, most of us do, and it's what stops us from living or becoming the truest, most beautiful version of ourselves, becoming the woman that the universe, or the man that the woman that the universe intended for us to be.
I'm glad you corrected that and added both genders. I was going to say, I mean, I do feel like I've grown into the woman that the universe wanted me to be as well, to be fair.
You say I work a lot with women.
I know. I was going to add, yeah, okay, well, I had a different question. That's just opened up a new one.
Oh, really?
Well, yeah, because now you've said it. You work mainly or a lot with women. Mm-hmm. I understand that implicitly because women are more attuned to their emotions and they're going to be, in theory, more open to exploring this stuff. Mm-hmm. Why do you feel like, go on.
Also, I'm a woman.
So sure, sure.
Yeah.
Understandable. But do you think though that for men, it is more of a block to want to step into that space? And if so, where do you think that comes from?
It's acculturated very much that men aren't allowed to be vulnerable, that they're not allowed to be emotional, that they're not allowed to express themselves in that way. And even though that has improved a lot of that.
Definitely. Yes, agreed.
I'm not saying it hasn't, but it's almost like there's this innate permission that women have to be, or almost an expectation, actually, that women are going to be more emotional. And that actually hasn't been my experience of it at all, working with humans in a more wider framework. But for me, it does come down to how we're brought up. So I actually wanted to talk about this with you anyway, and let's bring it back to something like sex and sexuality. Mm-hmm. For a woman, she experiences her sexual energy as a mate, and then externalizes that often within our culture as a means to manipulate and control. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is this kind of sense that, again, that's how we actualize this kind of energy, where for men it's to kind of, in a lot of ways, I always struggle talking about genderized stuff because I don't want it to sound like I'm being dualistic.
But in some ways, we're talking about it from the perspective of energy, not gender politics. I think that's the distinction to make here, right? Because it's not about, unless I'm mistaken, I mean, it is male and female bodies, but also not in mm-hmm. some ways. Go with it, and then we'll just...
And it's this idea about for a man, in a lot of ways, in our culture, it's this idea of domination, actually, and power. That in order to feel
fulfilled or whole,
mm-hmm.
it's possession based.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but on the exact reverse of that, for a woman, it's also about control and manipulation. And so we're both kind of, and when your locus of control, I keep using this expression, but when you're externalized in the way that you look at the world, it's almost like, again, if you bring it back to what exists fundamentally is the energy behind it. Mm-hmm. And if the energy and the feeling and the experience of it is mine, and I own that and I'm sovereign over that, mm-hmm. then what he or she is doing or how he or she is behaving it's not about that. Then it's a mutual, I guess it's a mutual sharing in that frame.
Well, that's what feels like a healthy dynamic should be, where both people are in that space. But mm-hmm. again, that's not as prevalent yet. And also, I guess if someone is able to operate from that vantage point, you don't have the need at all to go out into the world with that idea of what am I getting? Mm-hmm. It's, I desire this person in my life. I want to spend time with them. I want to grow and cultivate with them. I want to just enjoy each experience mm-hmm. as it is. And if more come, amazing, mm-hmm. but not feel the need to use those tactics mm-hmm. what you were describing of control and domination. Just, mm-hmm. I think they're the same thing, just different shades.
Yeah. I completely agree.
Men use it more implicitly because we're not quite as subtle and as smart as women are in that capacity.
I think women are very overt about the way they use their sexuality to manipulate.
Some are and some aren't. I mean, broad brush strokes, right? Like it's going to be different across the board.
I mean, but to be fair, I've experienced both sides of that coin, and it feels like a very similar energy because it's all about control at the end of the day.
And that's where I find it interesting, because we're talking about it from the point of view of energy. And I do believe that there is that innate side of both the female and masculine energy within everybody. But obviously within the gender that we're in, we mm-hmm. will lie towards one more than another, naturally. Mm-hmm. And they all have their values. Mm-hmm. But you said balance before, and I thought that was quite important. I think, is it about having an understanding of both sides and having that inner balance? For mm-hmm. a guy to go, I do have feminine energy, it doesn't mean I'm feminine. It doesn't mm-hmm. mean I'm a chick. Or that I'm a whatever thing that a high school kind of guy would throw at, you know, mm-hmm. another dude.
Yeah.
It's not frat boy central. It's feminine energy being receptivity to emotions, to the world, being more grounded, being more ethereal. Mm-hmm. We can tap into that to be able to express those emotions. Mm-hmm. Masculine energy being a little bit more direct, achieving, going out there, doing your thing, creating and building. Mm-hmm. Women need to tap into that energy too, and they do, and we see it in the corporate world.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I think humanity as a general rule has shifted too far into that masculine kind of
sure.
archetypal masculine. I'm not talking about we all behave like men. Yeah.
No, but that's the balance, right? That's being able to say, you know, how can that woman who works in that corporate environment come home and let all of that go to be able to just tap into a different side of her energy? It's like the shadow and light that you were talking about before. If I'm only operating from the point of view of unicorns and light and everything's hunky-dory,
yep.
then how can I ever even truly appreciate what that is without having the contrast?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And so I think it applies in the same way to sexuality and romantic relationships.
Mm-hmm.
But it's that inward journey.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that so much of us are kind of looking to experience ourselves in a more whole way. I think post-COVID, in a post-COVID world, even going out, like last night I was in my local park, and they've created like this whole outdoor dining situation, and it's just fabulous, and it's just so nice to see people back outside and relating to each other again. But how do we do relationships in a post-COVID world
mm-hmm.
as well? Like, that is going to be really interesting, because I think we've all kind of gone within for this period of time, and I think I think that's really going to start shifting around, as to see and just to see how people are going to start relating to one another again. Because I know, you know, I've this whole digital space has really taken off during the pandemic as well.
Oh, so are you saying you feel like there might be more reliance on just still using this kind of interfacing as opposed to in-person connection?
The old IRL. Yeah, like, you know, like it's almost bizarre now to actually meet up with people in real life, which is just, yeah, it's, I'm going to be interested to see what comes up as a result of it, that's for sure.
I guess that's the other thing of, you know, will it be like any of these big, terrible events that at the beginning, there is more empathy and more sort of openness because people have A, missed the in real life stuff, and B, it's been so long since they've had that kind of connections on a bigger scale.
Mm-hmm.
But then does that empathy just naturally, because of how we're wired as humans, dissipate as the distractions start to come back? Because they will.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be the interesting thing, right? Because it's almost a litmus test of what has everybody learned from this period, and how much work have they done mm-hmm. to then be able to manage those distractions when they reappear or are more prominent in our lives.
Yeah. And I mean, and I know even for myself, this is going to be such an interesting thing because, yeah, it's so many of my relationships have been forced onto the kind of digital platforms and, you know, and actually to go and spend time with people. I know I'm even finding it quite exhausting at the moment, like to actually go and sit and have an actual conversation. And yeah, I mean, there's always challenges. There always is. But I think we're learning to really experience ourselves differently and to navigate it in a very different way now. For sure.
That feels like it's sort of the underpinned theme of this whole chat, which is, you know, experiencing ourselves mm-hmm. and learning how to do that and mm-hmm. navigating that space. What kind of shifts have you seen with some of the people that you've been working with? Obviously, I know you can't speak to it with specifics, but you know, when you see the shift in a client or someone you're working with, what's that like for you working with them? And, you know, can you sometimes tell before they can?
It's funny with emotional well-being and mental health, I think. People, the changes are really incremental and small. And so, you know, you'll start to see people showing up in their lives in a different way. Mm. And we're so used to being so cerebral about everything, you know, that we're very linear and we want to think about things. And as you just pointed to, it's allowing people to experience themselves differently in that moment. And I think oftentimes what we are taught to do, we want to actually understand it intellectually rather than to let ourselves experience things. And so ultimately for me, there is a marriage that needs to happen, and on a wider level, and I see it happening all the time with my clients, where all of a sudden who they are rises up and who they think they are, and they kind of, you know, gets drawn back in, and they kind of meet in the middle. And then they start setting boundaries for people. They start showing up for themselves in a different way. You know, I feel like people pleasing is very much, it's a huge part of our culture that we, as you mentioned before, that we don't have the difficult conversations because we don't want to be the bad guy. And it's almost like, whereas when you have that self-actualized or when you're learning to navigate your own emotions, you can show up for yourself and not be full of fear all the time. And it is a beautiful thing to see someone blossom. And I think for me, that's why I do the work I do, because I find it so rewarding. And for me, it's about service. It's about showing up every single day. And, you know, and I believe that you teach by the strength of your example as well. Like, I feel like you need to walk your walk as well. You know, you have to, I think, and actually, I don't think, I don't teach people. I mean, I guide people. I certainly, and I feel like I do in some ways I teach, but I feel like it's not through instruction that you teach. It's about allowing people to show up in relationship in a different way. They show up with me and they can be radically honest. They show up and they can, you know, talk about those crunchy, uncomfortable things that they do not want to talk about with any other single person in their life. And once you learn to do that in that relational space, that gets taken out and you get a little bit more confident and you see them kind of start to peek their head up above the, you know, like a meerkat, like up above the thing and like up above the threshold and kind of start to go, oh shit, like I can do this. I can have tough conversations. I can, as Glennon Doyle says, I can do hard things. Mm-hmm. Have you read that book?
No.
Untamed. Oh my God, if you haven't read it.
Wait. No, I've not read it, but it rings a bell.
Yeah. Untamed by Glennon Doyle. It's worth a read. But it's almost like you see them start to get that confidence in themselves and who they really are, because it's not an artifact. It's not something that they've created in their head. It's grounded in truth, like truth with a capital T. And that's not something that I can give you, you know, points for, or it's not, that journey is completely unlinear. It's this constant, it for me and the way I work, it's almost this constant battle between I've always, and my clients get sick of me. How is it feeling? How are you feeling? What's the feeling? Lauren, not with enough with the feelings, right? But always bring it back to, okay, oh, but I think this and this, but okay, but how does it feel? How are you experiencing yourself? Does it feel crunchy? Does it feel liberating? Do you feel freer? Do you feel smaller? Do you feel, you know, one of the things I always use with my clients actually is, does it feel, you know, is it life affirming or is it life depleting? So this is a little, actually, there is a little thing that I do.
Because that's a self-awareness thing, right? Like you could use that in your everyday. It's, you know, I'm about to make a decision. Is this life affirming or is it life, what did you say?
Depleting. Yeah. So it's almost like I'll go to send a text to someone and I'll be like, oh, I'm not sure. Like, does it make me feel stronger to say this or does it make me feel weaker?
Yeah.
And if the answer is, I don't know.
That's from a place, I want to categorize this quickly. That's from a place of a feeling and an energy, not from a place of ego, patriarchal power or control.
Precisely.
Okay.
Yeah. And so even this, to a certain extent, you've got to have done a degree of work to be able to sense. And then if I'm not sure if it's life affirming or life depleting, then I will go and get more facts.
Or just step away for a while and put down the grenade.
There's no need for that urgency then. But again, that even that in itself, as you're saying, it does take a certain level of self-awareness, because I could also send a message and go, okay, oh, is this going to manipulate this person into doing what I want them to do?
And then you overthink it. Then you overthink it so much, you don't even know anymore. So you're just manipulating yourself.
Yeah.
It's the mind fuck that we do on ourselves that causes more issues than anything.
And again, like I spend 3/4 of my time trying to get people out of their head and into how they're experiencing themselves.
And is that through just conversation or?
Yeah, I use a process called convergence as well, which is much like the old school hypnotherapy, where I get people to kind of almost journey to kind of navigate their internal emotional landscape. So we create almost like a landscape within them that they can go to.
Right. So is it meditative or is it not, or is it deep in
there? I kind of, it's again, it's on because it's experiential. It's one of those things you have to experience. You can't intellectualize, but basically, yeah, it's where we're basically converging our outer reality and our inner world so that they can have a dialogue with each other. And yeah, it's kind of based on old school kind of hypnosis / my mentor taught me how to do it, her mentor taught her. It's one of those things that's kind of been handed down. It's not a classical technique at all, but it's almost like getting our minds and our bodies to kind of interact, because unfortunately we're kind of almost cut off from here down in a lot of ways.
Gotcha.
And does that kind of make sense? I hope it does.
Sort of. I mean, is it something that you can do unto yourself, or do you have to be the one guiding the other person?
It can be helpful both ways. It's something that people can use once they've learned how to do it, that they can use by themselves in their own life. Alternatively, you know, it's great to sometimes dialogue it with another person, because you've actually got another person to hold the space for you.
Yeah.
But both. To answer that question,
I'm guessing from more of a science physics sort of to ground it perspective, what I assume is happening is, from a mental and mind perspective, you are altering the frequency of what the brain is operating at to drop into more of that subconscious level of operating and sort of tapping into a different state of what the brain waves operate at, or is it not quite?
Well, I mean, if you want to talk about the neuro kind of chemistry or neuroanatomy of it, the human brain developed, you know, the reptilian brain at the start, you know, that kind of, you know, and then you've got your whole prefrontal cortex, that whole kind of cerebral area.
Yep.
So when I say we're becoming cerebral, I quite literally mean like we're becoming cerebral. So then it's like grounding it back into that reptilian brain, that the brain stem, the amygdala, that whole bit of your neurochemistry that connects your mind and your body through the vagus nerve, actually. Mm-hmm. And it's actually about then almost journeying back through your mind into your body, because we become so mind identified, that voice in our head, if you want to talk about it from the Eckhart Tolle kind of Mickey Singer, those guys constantly talk about the voice in your head. We're cerebral. We're identified with the voice that's in our head and not with our experience of ourselves. So it's very visceral, drawing back to those very, you know, the emotional components, because we've become too mind identified. And so if you want to dichotomize it as body and mind, you know, cerebral or emotional,
sure.
However, yeah. And ultimately, they talk about rewiring neural pathways, but it's actually just more tonifying that those parts of the brain that connect mind and body.
Okay. So by that, you're saying it's more about just tapping into those parts that were innately there already, as opposed to creating new neural pathways in the prefrontal cortex.
Yes.
And no.
there probably wouldn't be enough neurochemical or neuroanatomical studies to, yeah.
It's such a sort of fledgling kind of arena anyway, that there's so much that still, I think, needs to be explored there with all that stuff.
Again, even talking about the neuroanatomy of it makes it cerebral again.
Sure.
Rather than it being experiential. And that's where most people's brain tweaks at that point. My brain usually tweaks at that point because I want to try and understand understand something that's not understandable.
Yeah.
And I think that's also a way I can distract myself from feeling my feelings, is to intellectualize them. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I tend to be very good at that.
I think we all do, right? That's just...
Yeah, well, I mean, that's half the reason I went and did all the study and the degrees and all that sort of stuff. I was trying to intellectualize something that I was, some really heavy stuff that I was experiencing. And I didn't want to feel it. So I know I'll go study it and I'll go and be able to tell everybody. And I had all this language for, you know, but I didn't want to feel it. Which is ironic that that's now what I teach.
Yeah, but I guess that's because by then understanding it conceptually, you are able to understand when it's showing up, to let yourself feel it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because you know what's happening. I mean, I think we're talking about intellectualizing like it is a bad thing. And, the ego gets a bad rap, and sometimes mm-hmm. for good cause. But mm-hmm. actually, we also need it. And it's not a bad thing. Yeah. It's just all of these things are parts of who we are, and it's understanding what they do so that we can then mm-hmm. I don't want to say use them, that sounds wrong, we can experience them, there we go, yeah. We can experience them in the ways that are most empowering, so that we can cultivate an experience outwardly as well as inwardly that's desirable, as opposed to, you know, facing brick walls all the time and being miserable with our lives and lashing out at people and just being on a mm-hmm. in a space that's not conducive to feeling happiness or joy.
Yeah. And I think ultimately peace is the most natural human state that I've experienced, is just that capacity to just let go and not have to be in control. And that's hard. To get to that place is really hard. Like it's ironic that to be peaceful takes a lot of work. It's simple, but it's not easy, you know?
Yeah. And also, do you think you get to that place, or do you think that it's something that you can tap into, but it's an ongoing thing? It's not like, okay, I'm at peace now, cool, got here. You know what I mean? It's sort of like, all right, well, I feel at peace now, then some other shit's happened, because we're also receiving from all the outward stuff. And, you know, mm-hmm. how can you manage your own energy and do that as a practice, so that each day what's coming at you isn't dwelling in you, so that your level of balance and inner sort of peace is destabilized that much? Because it's like a metronome, right? And I think we're not going to be sort of centered all the time. So it's an ongoing practice.
I love that. Yes and no.
Yeah.
I think, okay, this is an interesting one, because are things coming at you, or are they presenting themselves for you to grow?
Sure.
So,
From the sensory perspective, again, if I think from my logical male brain, I'm just talking about what in the three yeah. That's right. I did it. I said it.
I went there.
Yep, I went there. I said it. No, but in the 3D physical world, the things that we experience outwardly are things that are being experienced through our implicit five senses. That's where I'm coming from, as opposed to, yes, I'm with you, how things show up as a potential lesson and journey and experience. Mm. It's that, you know, horse and cart kind of analogy. Yeah. Have I manifested this, or is it just happening randomly and I'm just a witness?
It's like peace is an experience. It's not a permanent state.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I think when you can find peace in even the most stressful situations, that's enlightenment ultimately. And we're all that's the practice, that's the work, as I would contextualize it, is to be able to experience that sense of groundedness, even if man's search for meaning, Viktor Frankl, you know, he's in a Nazi concentration camp. Like, you can find peace there. I'm sorry, if that dude can find peace there, we've all got this. Like, COVID is a cakewalk.
Yeah.
Seriously. Yeah. And I think, yeah, anybody that's interested in that kind of idea of transcending ego, or transcending that kind of, that part of us that needs this to be okay in order for this to be okay, just read that book, and it's just like, oh, okay, still got some work to do. Because that guy the other day that, you know, mouthed off at me at the post office, you know, really fucking resenting him right now. Yeah, like
yeah.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And because it does, and that stuff still throws me off balance as well. Like,
sure.
Yeah.
Which is a thing. It's okay for those things. It's the awareness of when it does, I guess, to sort of come back into yourself, reground, and go.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's accountability. Sort of wrap this up on maybe a final kind of note. You said responsibility, accountability. They're probably interchangeable, but it's even if someone or something has done something or a thing has happened outwardly,
mm-hmm.
what good does it do to you to put your energy out into blaming, shaming, whatever you want to do, that thing?
Mm-hmm.
How can you find the more empowered approach to mm-hmm. dealing with it? Whether it's true or not doesn't matter. It's just what's going to serve you
mm-hmm.
as opposed to what's going to drain you in that moment. Mm-hmm. And
yeah,
I guess that is the work.
And I mean, I go into self-indignant rage about 25 times a day. Like,
hell yeah.
Yeah. Like, I love that one. It's one of my favorites. Like, how dare they? You know, like, someone doesn't, like, I've got this really narrow street at the front of my flat, and like, people have got to pull in. And like, for some reason, like, there's always that person that like tries to go down the middle and not pull in. And like, then, yeah, it's just a nightmare. And like, it's, yeah, so I get self-indignant rage about that at least a few times a day. So it's like, yeah, okay, this is where my work is, because I'm experiencing something other than peace in that moment. Why do I give a shit if someone's like driving like an idiot?
And is that the framing, do you think? So when that stuff comes up, it's, this is what my work is? Like, yeah. Is that almost like the calling to reflect for yourself?
Yeah, it's like, and get curious. Like what I was saying earlier, just to get curious, it's to have the awareness, first of all, I'm getting disproportionately annoyed at this dude. Then to have the curiousness and just to go, okay, what does this mean? Like, where is this coming from? Is this coming from, you know, like, you obviously don't want to be doing this 45 times a day, because we do still have to live.
Yeah.
You can also get too introspective. But again, it's almost like, yeah, okay, so how can this serve me? How can I, and that's the alchemy, that's the moment that you can transmute those emotions into something more functional.
That's the better framing, isn't it? It's how can this serve me, not what does this mean about me? Because how can this serve me, I suppose, is more about what's empowering.
Yeah.
Otherwise, the other framing is more like, what did I do wrong, is how you could interpret it, or, mm-hmm. you know.
Oh, God, yeah.
You know, because, what I mean?
Yeah, just as much as self-indignant rage is kind of not very useful, then also on the other hand, like, self-flagellation or like beating yourself up is also not very useful.
Yeah, yeah. No, you know, we don't want to be there.
Again, it's, how does this serve me? What is this serving to show me about myself and about what's going on for me, or, you know, how I'd prefer to show up in the world? Because to be honest, I would prefer that guy on the street didn't wind me up.
Mm-hmm.
But,
and, you know, I think that's a thing, right? Like, sometimes it actually isn't you or doesn't have anything to do with you, and it's just the other person. And, you know, we're all sharing this space on this rock with all these other billions of people,
mm-hmm.
and thinking of it from the vantage point of, how can this serve me or empower me, feels a lot healthier and more grounded than either A, it's my fault, or B, fuck them.
Yeah. Exactly. And I wish that I could show up like Eckhart Tolle all day. Like, that guy's voice, like, I swear to God, it's just so, like, the most soothing thing in the whole world.
Yeah.
But, you know, most of us will never get to that. And I'm okay with that. Like, I'm okay with the occasional bit of self-indignant rage, as long as it's not getting to the point where I am, like using on something, or, you know, like take that to an extreme. And in the past, old mate out the front on the road would have enough to have me, like, you know, doing lines on the toilet, you know, seat five hours later, you know. So there is an extent to which.
And that's the manifestation of the stuff that we were talking about, where people have gone, and especially in this period, tried to soothe themselves based on whatever rejection they were feeling from the pandemic by drugs, alcohol, prescription drugs, random relationships, hooking up with this person, drinking, all this.
During COVID, there would have been nothing more, there is nothing more kind of pathological almost than random hookups. Like, because let's face it, like, yeah, potentially every other human is a pathogen at that point.
Well, you're not going to really get to know the real person in that time anyway, because of the fucking restrictions we've had, for starters. But secondly, you're not coming together in a space where that's clearly just loneliness and feeling empty in some way and needing another thing. Mm-hmm. Shiny new toy syndrome is what I like to call it. And then after 3 to 6 months, you realize, well, when I did that, it was such a different world. And now the world's changed a little bit. Fuck, what a mistake I might have made. But I thought it was the best thing in the world at the time. And it was the Prince Charming. My industry has a lot to answer for, I think. Hollywood has done us a... I want to see the movie where we start the movie when they've already got together. Not have that be the ending.
You need to write that script, Ash.
It won't get made. Because it doesn't sell.
Will it though?
I don't know. Maybe if I make it like Ghetto on my own dime, but I don't want to do that anymore.
Show me the money.
Exactly. I mean, maybe there was Blue Valentine with Ryan Gosling, which was, I think, there have been a few. I'm being unfair. Like Marriage Story, Scarlett Johansson, and
I haven't watched that yet, actually.
Adam Driver.
Yeah.
And it's not like about a super happy, like, it's just a bit more real.
Yeah.
But I do think that historically and then they get together at the end and
I think a lot of that stuff is driving hookup culture as well, because people, again, like, it's that external, they're externalizing those interactions to the point where, like, intimate involvement with someone has become cerebral. It isn't embodied. Mm-hmm. And that does drive hookup culture, I'm going to say, because when you can rationalize to yourself, oh yeah, you know, that intimacy is something that could just purely be casual or purely physiological. It's almost, again, it's that disconnection between mind and body. And I talk to, you know, a lot of elderly people, and elderly people I just find fascinating, and like they talk about this kind of the sacredness that's kind of gone out of that all of those interactions, really.
Well, there's a difference, right? I guess if they've been together with their significant other for many, many, many years, they've seen the reality of what true love, I think, is, and that fostering of being there with that person to give in a mutual kind of exchange, but also you're going through all the ups and downs, as opposed to immediate gratification, which is obviously pervaded by this just entitled era that we all seem to be in, exasperated by social media, because we're now so used to dopamine hit on demand that when you get it from a like, you then think it's got to be the same with, again, it's the same with jobs. I remember when I was hiring people, and, you know, way back when in jobs, there were people that would come after a year and just expect a pay rise and a promotion after a year.
Yeah. And it's this neurochemical high. Ultimately, it's like we're dosing ourselves up on neurochemistry the same way that, you know, in the past addicts would have done with drugs and alcohol.
Mm.
It's this, yeah, it's this idea that this constant, and adrenaline is one, that we're literally, and dopamine, as you mentioned, but sure. Adrenaline is one of those interesting ones. We get it when we drink coffee, we get it when something amazing happens. It's any sort of intensity, actually. And so I think that's where hookup culture actually comes from as well. It's that adrenaline.
Excitement.
Yes, it's the excitement and the intensity.
Yeah. Well, it's that new relationship energy in the first few months where, because it's all new, you only see through blinkered eyes the best parts of the person, because no one's going to show all the kind of nooks and crannies that easily out the gate. You only see that after, I say, a good year of knowing someone. You start to see the person, and then it's okay, well, do I like all these sides of them? Do they like all those sides of me? Then that manifests into actual love, not lust or whatever that other thing is where we make bad decisions sometimes.
Yeah, it's for me, this whole, like, after a year, you do get to see all of those aspects and those sides of another person. But it's like intimacy and intensity aren't the same thing.
Sure. That's more what I was meaning. That's more what I meant, that the intimacy is you build it and it's long standing. But it also, again, it's
20-something year old Lauren thought intimacy and intensity were the same thing.
I think
Oh my god. That's the same thing as, like,
That's the Disney thing. The intensity thing is, you know, Beauty and the Beast, Cinderella, Happy Ever After story. And we're going to feel the chemical drop. But that intensity can never last. So you either chase intensity and you keep jumping from person to person and never feel fulfilled. Or you get, oh, I'm going to go so corny and cliche. You get intimate with yourself. To then be intimate with someone else and you feel more fulfilled in the long run. Check, please.
Yeah, right. You just summed it up. That's perfect. And nobody ever need watch a relationship video again.
Don't do that. I want to quickly, and then we'll wrap this up because I know you have a call in 20 minutes. Adrenaline is an interesting one because I've not really touched on that. Dopamine I get. Adrenaline I'm intrigued by. And I'm also intrigued by the polar opposite of that, in the sense of, do you think that the pursuit or desire for that adrenaline kick is perpetuated by the complete lack of opportunities to experience that in the way we've normally experienced it? I'm thinking in the last year. And by that, you know, we haven't been able to have access to all these things that would give us those feelings. Do you think that's what propels people to then chase those quick adrenaline junkie hits? Or the rejection of our life dissipating and everything we know disappearing, does that cause people to reach for the dopamine, reach for the adrenaline, because it's going to tap over the clunky bits?
Well, yeah. And I mean, I think it comes back down to, we talked about dopamine. And so we talked about the connection chemical, you know, and then, you know, but with adrenaline, it's really different. And it's like, you know, the people you see adrenaline junkies jumping out of planes and stuff. And that's, I guess, the more extreme end of the spectrum. But, you know, you can even see it in the way that people drink so much coffee now, because it's adrenalizing. It's that constant state of hypervigilance. And that can be useful. As I said, like, that anxiety, that adrenalized kind of state can be really useful. It can make you high functioning. The problem is when you get too much adrenaline and you bottom out, you know, and then you're exhausted. And so it's almost about finding, and again, it always comes back to the self, because it's about finding enough excitement and freshness and keeping, you know, but then at the same time learning to be peaceful as well. And I think, I heard it a little while ago, and it was basically, you know, when you can see a person show up and be fully who they are and be fully present. And, you know, and that ability to do that is really, really what drives, intrigue and excitement in people. Again, it's like looking for love in the wrong place. So adrenaline in and of itself isn't a bad thing, but when it isn't coming from an embodied kind of grounded place, then it's just thrill seeking, basically. It's just, I'm just trying to get my kicks to try and avoid myself. Whereas if I'm doing that from a place of groundedness and of presence and of awareness, then the outcome isn't, I don't know.
It feels more authentic because it's not.
Yeah, I think I'm pulling too many concepts out of the sky though here, because basically what you're asking me is about adrenaline as in of itself. And I think, yeah, too much adrenaline in our system is not a good thing.
Sure.
At all. We are brought up, or we live in a culture that is very much
chase the thrill.
Those thrills. Yeah. Chasing those vanity metrics, those likes, and when they come, and when we get that neurochemical high, it's no different to taking drugs or drinking or it's about understanding that cocktail of neurochemistry that's kind of going on. But I don't actually think that answers your question, but that's what I've got at this point. My head's
there was a lot in there. Yeah, we've covered a lot of ground. I think that's a cue to maybe wrap this one up. For anyone that's still listening to this point, I hope your brain hasn't melted.
Mine has.
In that case, I hope your brain has melted then. Let's just wrap it up. I always like to sort of have some final comment to button it off with. What would be, from your point of view, the sort of key underlying message or takeaway you'd want people tuning into this to leave with?
You can experience yourself differently, and that just because this is how you're feeling now doesn't mean it's always going to be this way. Big thing that I would say.